Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Ross, the Honorable Michelle A. Larkin presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to this session of the Minnesota Court of Appeals on November 10th, 2021. We're hearing our oral arguments this morning on the Zoom format. The rules are the same in terms of time allotted to each of the attorneys. Please be sure to state your name for the record before you present your argument so the record is clear regarding who is speaking. And be mindful of the timekeeping mechanism, which on my screen at least displays in the center left of the screen. And also be mindful of attempts to interrupt you for questioning by the judges. With that, we're ready to hear from appellate counsel in the first case, Kay Bryden versus Transit Team Incorporated.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kay Nordhunt and I represent the appellant's transit team in Getchachu Waldehaus. Appellants are before the court this morning seeking reversal of the trial court's denial to them of summary judgment dismissal. Appellant Waldehaus, who I refer to as driver, is entitled to dismissal on official immunity grounds. An appellant transit team is entitled to dismissal on vicarious of immunity grounds. Driver was a driver operating a Metro Mobility van which transports the elderly and people with disabilities and other special needs. Metro Mobility has only one employee on each bus, the driver, but does allow for a personal care attendant to ride with the rider with special needs for free. While the driver is to provide assistance and or support during the loading and unloading process, in doing so, the driver must take into consideration how the passenger wants to be assisted, and the drivers are taught to use their own judgment as to how much assistance a particular passenger needs, because drivers are confronted with a wide variety of disabilities. The video, which is part of the record here, shows that when drivers stopped the bus, Ms. Bryden instantly took off her shoulder and lap belt and her personal attendant left the bus without looking back. Driver went to the back, picked up the lap and shoulder belt and removed the scooter tie downs. And the video shows the movement by him consistent with storage of the straps. Driver was with Ms. Bryden when she adjusted her scooter backward. He told her how to turn. And when she had stopped, he turned around to leave to go outside the van to open the van door in order to operate the lift. Ms. Bryden testified she knew the driver would leave her to open the side gate and to operate the lift, and that she would just sit there while the driver left her. For some unknown reason, Ms. Bryden moved the scooter after that, and when she said she was falling, the driver, who had not yet left the van, went back and cradled her to lower her to the floor. Now, Ms. Bryden has ridden Metro Mobility hundreds of times with her scooter. Ms. Bryden testified that when she backed up the scooter that day, she did not feel she needed help from her personal assistant, and she was being watched enough by the driver. Here, the very nature of the driver's duty involving assisting people with all kinds of needs requires independent judgment and discretion with regard to passenger assistance. Bryden argues the driver should have gone outside to operate the lift and then release the tie downs, and the driver was negligent in failing to do so. But there is no protocol or rule that designates that specific action by the driver. Under these circumstances, the lack of that protocol supports that what the driver was doing here was not ministerial. And driver, exercising his discretion and judgment, viewed Bryden not in need of further aid while he went to open the lift. Official immunity applies.
Okay, if I could ask a quick question. Should we be parsing each of Bryden's theories? Because, so if there's no protocol or rule on that, I mean, do we decide if that then is ministerial or discretionary? There is the statute about securement devices should be retracted, removed, or otherwise stowed. So that does seem, you know, I wouldn't incline to say maybe that's ministerial, but how closely do we parse these? And what's your position on that?
Well, with regard to parsing them, you do have to parse the notion here that that there was somehow negligence in untying the straps and going out. So that's one parse of it. With regard to stowing the straps, it seems to me that if the first part is discretionary, I'm not sure how stowing the straps enters into it. With regard to stowing the straps, if you parse that separately, that I agree with you would be ministerial, but based on the record before the court, that ministerial duty was complied with, so official immunity would still apply. If you have the unusual situation,
isn't that kind of a fact issue? And I will also tell you that we don't have the videotape in front of us. I mean, it was not submitted with the record. So go ahead.
I was just going to speak to that. We weren't aware of this until we started preparing for the case. And my clerk does intend to obtain the video if it's part of the court record. So we will have it available to us, but we've not had an opportunity to review it for the hearing.
And I think it's very important for the court to look at that. And that's exhibit one to our declaration, because, you can look at that video. And what Bryden says in her answers to interrogatories, which are part of the summary judgment record.
Judge Larkin, I just want on this point, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I want to make this point and following up on Judge Siegel's question. Although we've not seen the video, the district court indicated that it watched the video and it was inconclusive. And you've cited a Supreme Court case that says, if you've got video evidence and it's conclusive, it doesn't matter that the party opposing summary judgment has presented a witness statement that contradicts it. If there's only one conclusion that can be reached from the video, there's no dispute of fact. My concern here, not having seen the video yet, which I will, is that even your description of what's on the video leads me to believe that it's inconclusive. In other words, I didn't read the brief as saying the video conclusively shows the driver stowing the traps. Instead, it was sort of a long description of what the video shows and an assertion that given what's in that video, there's no other reasonable conclusion except that he stole the straps. That to me seems to be circumstantial evidence. And I question whether summary judgment is appropriate based on a conclusion drawn from circumstantial evidence. Circling back to Judge Siegel's question, that seems to be weighing of the evidence and fact-finding that shouldn't occur on summary judgment. So I want you to know that I'm going into the video with that in my mind. Do you want to shed light in terms of what's in the video separately from what you've described in your brief?
Well, what's on the video is the fact that there is no showing of any straps on the ground. There's no verbalization or action by anyone consistent with there being any straps on the ground. So that's what you have. The problem is you haven't seen the video, but
isn't that different than the Supreme Court case you cited in which, you've got, a statement on tape, I think, or a recorded statement that completely rebunked. I mean, what you're saying is we should conclude from the lack of evidence in the video that the straps were stored. To me, that's different than a video that shows him storing the straps and there's no other interpretation of the video.
Well, what the video shows is the driver's movement consistent with stowing the straps. There is no other explanation for it. And in the driver's deposition, it was step by step with the driver explaining what he was doing on the video. So not only do you have the video, you have the driver going by. And if you look at the deposition of the driver, it has the code of the video. so you can correlate it with where he is. And so that's why it's conclusive. And I agree, Judge Frazier decided it was not, but in the US Supreme Court case, if you recall, both the district court and the Court of Appeals went one way, and the US Supreme Court said, well, wait a minute, we're looking at this video and we find it conclusive. And that's why I say that it's important for this court to take a look at that video and take a look at it in conjunction with the deposition of the driver.
And that we will do, counsel. I have another question circling back to Judge Siegel's first question, which is one that I had as well. You know, there seem to be like maybe three theories as to why the driver was negligent. And you're saying, okay, well, the first one has to do with leaving, you know, the truck before she's positioned, and that's discretionary. And once you decide that, game over. But my question is, what if you get to the second theory, which is buckling the straps, which could be negligence, and that's ministerial, and we're not convinced that the straps were stowed? I mean, couldn't the case still go forward on that theory? I mean, I understand the question, and what I was thinking about in terms of parsing is, do we literally have to say, okay, you have immunity on this theory, not on this theory, on this theory, and as long as there's one theory for which there isn't immunity, the case goes forward?
You do have to go action by action, and that's what has happened in other cases by the Minnesota Supreme Court. So the Minnesota Supreme Court has said, okay, here you're entitled to official immunity. Here it's ministerial, but you know, there's no negligence or the duty was complied with. So you do have to go through it step by step. So we know if the court should disagree with us, that it is our view that all of this is immunity and we're done.
But let me ask, and so I think, what are the three theories again? We've got, you know, should you stay with the person and not leave the truck until the person is positioned? We've got the straps, and refresh my memory, what's the third theory that the district court considered?
Well, the first one that you mentioned is that you should stay with the person, but, you know, that's impossible because you have to leave the van to operate the lift.
Unless you haven't unstrapped the person, isn't the rule that you stay with the person once they're unstrapped? Because you could leave the person strapped in place, go out. Isn't that the point they're trying to make?
Right. So I think there's two. The one is keep her strapped. And then the second is with the stowage of the straps.
And aren't those kind of addressed in the statute, in the rules? Here's what you must do. And aren't they both ministerial then?
No. With regard to how the driver decides to have her when he leaves the van is not ministerial at all. As he explained that, you know, people don't want to be tied up. What he does is he goes back and unties the straps, gets her position, she stops, and she testifies to that. This is what she does. And then he goes out and does the lift. And for whatever reason, even before he left the van, she decided to move again.
Well, let me ask this. Does anything prevent him from leaving the straps in place, going to the back, adjusting the lift, and then removing the straps and being present while she positions herself?
No, nothing does that.
Does something require that? I was left with the impression that that's maybe a requirement that's either stated or is reasonably inferred from the notion that you don't leave an unstrapped person, the mechanism, unattended in the van.
There is no such requirement. Okay. There is discussion in the rule with regard to a situation where you may do it that way, keep her strapped and go out, but it's in the terms of may. It's not a requirement that it be done that way. And if you can see, you're dealing with, you know, people with different needs, and you have a situation here. If you look at what Ms. Bryden, I mean, you know, even before the driver can get back there, she's throwing off her lap belt. She's ready to go. So what he does is he assists her in backing up, and then goes out. So, I mean, part of the rules are that you are to pay attention to the particular person and their particular needs, and that's what he did here.
So can I ask just a quick question, even though we're running? Okay. So back to the video, which we will see and we will get in review, but in deciding whether that's conclusive or inconclusive, aren't we then ruling on the summary judgment motion on negligence, the summary judgment for negligence? And why can that be done on an interlocutory appeal?
Well, because if the court agrees that the straps were stowed and it is ministerial and it was complied with, that official immunity still applies, as the Minnesota Supreme Court has recognized, and that ends the case.
But we can decide the official immunity with deciding whether it's ministerial or not without getting into the merits of whether the individual complied with that. It seems like that's not an appropriate part of an interlocutory appeal. That's more for the merits, or maybe on remand, for example, if this case were to be remanded. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I disagree with Your Honor on that, because the Minnesota Supreme Court on multiple occasions has decided, one, if it was a ministerial duty and looking at the record, it was complied with, that ends it. It's official immunity. You always also have the case that I cited to this court where it wasn't even raised below whether there was no negligence, and this court wouldn't address it. And the Minnesota Supreme Court said on the record before it, there was no negligence. So there is great leeway that is given the court in these interlocutory appeals.
Is the leeway given to this court, or is that just something the Supreme Court does? Because the Supreme Court does a lot of things we can't do, and they're not afraid to tell us we shouldn't do those things.
No, it is the leeway that is certainly given to this court, especially with regard to the issue of if you conclude that the ministerial duty was complied with, that's a decision this court can make. And then the official immunity applies, because you have the official immunity applies if you have a ministerial duty, if it was complied with anyway.
I realize the time is up, but might I ask one question further?
Yes, please.
Thank you. I'm wondering, Ms. Hunt, whether your argument allowing for full discretion by the driver and allowing the driver to qualify for immunity for that purpose would sort of swallow all possibility of negligence if the driver is allowed, for example, discretion to decide which technique to use, whether the technique is reasonable. If the driver decides to employ a completely unreasonable technique, it seems that your position is that because the driver gets to choose the techniques and the methods for safety, there essentially can be no liability because the driver is immune for the discretionary act. Correct me if I'm taking your argument too far.
You are taking my argument too far, because there are policies in place, but there is no policy in place with regard to this particular, how you deal with these straps and the scooter. So, you know,
I guess that's my question. I mean, policies can only go so far and only identify certain circumstances. But if there's a circumstance that was completely unforeseeable in the policies, and the driver just chooses what may be construed by reasonable persons as an unreasonable act, your view is that outside the policy, within the driver's discretion, never any liability.
That's correct. I mean, that's what official immunity does.
But your position would then be the driver would get to choose. The driver has discretion to choose an objectively unreasonable method.
Well, you always have the other piece of it is if there was, maliciousness or on the other end of it.
No malice, just unreasonableness.
Right. And well, but the issue is, I mean, you see this in all of the official immunity cases where the argument could be, well, you're just allowing it to go too far. But I mean, the fact is that if you have a situation where you have someone that needs to exercise discretion in these different situations, I mean, that is where official immunity applies.
Thank you. We'll now hear from counsel for respondent. Sir, would you introduce yourself for the record before providing your argument?
Yes, Your Honor. This is Mark Nolan, and I represent Kay Bryden in this matter. Let me speak to some of the things that were discussed in order. With regard to the stowage of the straps, you'll note when you see it that the video does not show the entire floor. And that is why the judge actually made a finding that the video was inconclusive. And I don't know that there's much more to say about that. Moving on to the issue of ministerial versus discretionary, we start with the idea that, or with the fact rather, that Kay Bryden is 79 years old at the time of this accident. She is blind. She also has multiple sclerosis. Another fact to consider is that the driver in this case admits that had he been at her side, this accident would not have happened. With regard to his saying that he has discretion in these instances, I know he said that at some point, but I urge you to take a look at the deposition of him. He says that somewhere about page 20 or so in his deposition. If you look at the deposition as it moves forward, pages 25 to 31, he is very carefully taken through all of the obligations that he has and directives that he must do. And it's very clear he does not have discretion. And he admits that he does not have discretion with regard to these matters. With regard to the statutes and directives, we've cited to the court two statutes. One is Minnesota 473.386, subdivision 6, that indicates that operators shall provide help necessary, including help, help necessary for door-through-door service, including help in entering and leaving the vehicle.
Okay. Counsel, could I stop you for a moment? In thinking about these issues, I think the door-to-door requirement is one that would allow some discretion. But I also think there might be some actions within that broader door-to-door process that aren't discretionary. Could you identify to us those things that must be done as part of that door-to-door service? I mean, stowing the straps is one. Are there any other requirements you can direct us to that are non-negotiable?
Yes. In the safety manual, first of all, it points out that at its introduction that you are dealing with the most vulnerable members of our society because of their disabilities. In also the manual indicates that when passengers and mobility devices are departing, we should, whenever possible, ride down the lift with the passenger. This may mean we deploy the lift and make certain that it is even with the vehicle prior to releasing the tie downs. So this driver had two options, but both of them are ministerial. Either do not release the tie downs until you've raised the lift up, then escort her over to the lift, or escort her to the lift and then where she doesn't have to move anymore. And keep in mind, she was backing up backwards in this situation. The either get her over to the lift so she doesn't have to move at all anymore, then bring the lift up and then go back to her.
Okay. And counsel, could you just clarify for me again so I can write it down? Where do we find the requirement that the straps are not to be released until the lift is in place? If you want to just tell me, it's in the manual or statute.
Oh, yes, it's in the manual.
In the manual. And is the manual the source of the requirement for stowing the safety straps as well?
That's in the statute.
That's in the statute. Okay. Are there any other statutory provisions or provisions in the manual that you would cite us to and argue that they're clear mandates and they were violated in this case and they constitute negligence, or that violation could constitute negligence?
I think that covers it, because those are our three theories: stowage of the straps, either not releasing the tie downs and until you've got the lift up and then taking her over, or else taking her to the lift and then getting it up to the level of the floor.
And that's the and that's in the manual as well?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
It's in the manual in that section I read to you, Judge. And I think the counsel will say, well, that says whenever possible, you should do that. Well, this was possible. So it's not a, so that caveat is gone in this instance.
But doesn't it say whenever possible, you should ride down the lift with the passenger? It doesn't say anything about escorting them. I mean, staying with them every minute when they're not tied down. I don't see that.
But the statute.
That's about riding down the lift with them. And I think there was some evidence where didn't the driver say I couldn't? And it recognizes that, I think, in the manual, that there may not be enough room when you're talking about scooters.
That's in riding down on the lift, not in these movements.
I'm sorry to waste time here, but what's the passage you're referring to?
With regard to riding down on the lift, or?
No. With regard to physically being with the passenger if they are not in tie downs.
Well, I go back to the statute there. As far as doors for door service, including help in entering and leaving the vehicle.
Okay, I understand.
Another point to be made in the discretionary versus ministerial, as Gleason indicates and as other case indicates, that there is some level of discretion does not mean that something is not ministerial. And Gleason has a very nice discussion on that. And it's also, if there a very recent case to look at relative to that is the Welters case. It just came down from your court October 25th. And that had language about handcuffs and what must be done to relative to them. And then it had language when necessary. And in essence, the court said the must language trumps the when necessary.
So if I could interrupt for a minute, how do you respond to Ms. Hunt's argument about, there is this whole notion of you're dealing with people here and what does the person want? There is a policy against, restraints, for example. And so if this rider, didn't want to be held hostage while the driver went to manage the lift, she's somebody who's very experienced. I mean, how do you respond to that argument?
Well, number one, that's the driver saying that that's the way it should be done. That's not what the safety manual says. That's not what the statutes say. He kind of gave this impression, well, I'm so concerned about them being comfortable that I evidently don't have to be concerned about safety. With regard to the discretionary language also, it's interesting that the all of the directives that we point to are in the language of must, shall, will. That's not discretionary language. We also had a related appeal, Your Honors, relative to whether, in fact, Transit Team was a public official, because that's in the analysis of immunity. You first determine whether they're a public official. Now, the court determined that that Transit Team was, and relied on Karanimi for that. We don't think this is a Karanimi case. I think the Karanimi was one of the broadest extensions of who's a public official, and it isn't in keeping with, say, RK Midway, which came out after Karanimi. Karanimi was a very unusual situation, and even in the decision, the court says, on these facts, they're finding that, for instance, the indemnity didn't make a difference. In this case, there was indemnity, and the defendants seemed to say that the Karanimi court said, well, that's not important at all, because of Karanimi not taking it into regard in their decision. Karanimi only said that it is not the sole decision as to whether an independent contractor is a public official. It didn't say that that is not an important consideration. And in fact, this court in RK Midway gave great weight to the idea that a contractor in a building situation had indemnity, and gave good reasons as to why that's a very important consideration. The court found that there was a lot of control over TT by the Metro Mobility, but it's not the same control as was present in Karanimi. In other words, Karanimi, the contract itself said that the parties were to be in close coordination. Our contract says that TT is to control the means and methods of delivery of the services.
But doesn't your argument a bit cut against your argument that these duties were ministerial? I mean, it seems like the district court was looking at some of the very same things you're pointing to say, well, this is a ministerial, not a discretionary action, because there's all these dictates in statute, in regulation, and imposed by Metro Transit, including the right by Metro Transit to remove drivers at their sole discretion, right? So help me out with that.
Well, it's two different issues. In other words, in the first thing you say, is it a government entity? Then you say, is it a public official if it's an independent contractor? And that's determined by control of the governmental entity over the independent contractor. So that analysis doesn't deal with whether it's ministerial or discretionary. In other words, just as the court found, I find that TT is a public official. So it passed that step. That's a separate step. Then it said, but even if it's a public official, we now get into the analysis of ministerial versus discretionary. And that's how it found two different things, because it's really two different analyses. The other thing that's important in determining whether TT is a public official, to some extent you could say, well, why did I even appeal this? Because if you affirm the ministerial and discretionary, you don't even have to go to this issue. But it's an important issue in that more and more cases are deciding whether somebody is a public official to meet that threshold for this analysis of discretionary and ministerial. So what is very important in Carinini in making it a public official, it could act, it was actually called the city public works director or whatever they called it, but it was called that city's public works director. TT is not called Metro Mobility and is not allowed to call itself. Equally importantly, this Bunastro, who was the public works person they hired, he had the right to bind the city. Right? And I say he, the company had the right to bind the city. That was a very important thing in finding that it was a public official. TT has none of these things. There are a lot of things. They say, well, it's a 200-page agreement. Most government contracts with an independent contractor are a 200-page agreement. But it didn't go to say, in that contract, it had a lot of reasons where it could monitor for adherence to the contract. And if you take a look at what they're talking about as control, it's really adherence to the contract. But that doesn't make somebody a public official. That's what's typically goes on between a principal and independent contractor. The
Council, I want, because your time is up here, I do have one question I'd like you to address. Going mm-hmm. back to the specifics you're relying on to establish ministerial duties, mm-hmm. I'm looking at the list on page 6 of your brief from the transit team safety manual, and I really want to press you on which of these apply to this situation and would indicate a ministerial duty. The first is the safety manual outlines the safety procedures that drivers must use every day. Well, that's sort of general. The next is passengers must be assisted or escorted during the loading and unloading process. Escort every passenger first door through first door. I mean, to me, that doesn't really provide specifics regarding what's must be done. It's sort of a general directive that would call for some discretion. The next is passengers either using a mobility device or ambulatory passengers are never to be left unattended either during the loading process or during transit. I don't know, does loading process include unloading as well?
I can't imagine that it wouldn't.
Yeah, that makes some sense. And then the next is for sight impaired ambulatory passengers. Does that even apply here? Are we assuming she's not ambulatory since she's using a mobility device and the prior rule presents those as either or circumstances? So I wonder whether the fourth safety provision you've cited would even apply here since she doesn't appear to be ambulatory if she's using a mobility device. And also that provision talks about leading the passenger by standing on the left side of the passenger and having the passenger grab onto their arm by the elbow or forearm and leading them to their destination. Would that occur if someone's using a mobility device?
Well, that's a reasonable point, Your Honor.
Okay. and I'm just, because these are the questions I'm going to have when I sit down and go through these with the panel. So I want to give you an opportunity. And then it says, when escorting wheelchair passengers, we will walk with the wheelchair passengers and passengers using scooters and open doors as needed. Does that provision apply inside of the van, or is that a provision that applies once you're outside of the van and getting to the home or the destination?
Why would it not? I mean, if you're to escort them outside the van, why would you not escort them inside the van?
Well, it says we will walk with them. Are you walking within the van?
Well, keep in mind that the driver admits that had he been at her side, this accident wouldn't happen.
Understood. And like I said, I just wanted, but just so that the panel's clear, you know, page 5 and 6 of your brief, those are the provisions we look to determine whether the three things you've identified are ministerial or not.
Yes. And I again urge the court to take a look at Welter and Gleason regarding the concept that.
And I will do that, but just to further clarify your argument for my purposes, at least, If this is the universe of possible rules that on which you rely, I don't see reference, you know, with the exception of the statutes that are first cited that talk about stowing the straps, I don't see anything that specifically addresses, you know, don't release the tie down straps until the manual is up. Where is that? Because that's not in this list you provided us in your brief.
That's in the court's order, and it's argued further in our brief.
Well, as I get that it's in the court's order, is that a rule you're arguing should exist given the directive, but it's not a rule that's in print that can't be disputed?
No, it is in print. It is in print. It's in
What's in print, and where is it?
In the safety manual.
And what does the safety manual say about not releasing tie downs until the lift manual is in place?
When passengers and mobility devices are departing, we should, whenever possible, and it was possible here, I ride down with the lift of the passenger. That may mean we deploy the lift and make certain it is even with the floor of the vehicle prior to releasing the tie downs.
Okay, but those are a lot of maze. What page is that on?
It's in the safety manual. I don't cite the page. I'm sorry.
Okay. And just to be clear, your the other references you gave were all directives. You shall, you must, we will. And I think the term you used was should in the language you're quoting. Am I correct? And if so, do you see a difference?
I don't know that I do see a difference. If you tell them this is what you should do, this is what you should do.
What you should do versus what you must do. Is there no difference? I guess, I mean, when I refer to difference, I'm referring to language that might appear to the court to be discretionary, possibly.
Yeah. I understand what you're saying, but I guess I don't agree in that. I guess if someone tells me this is what you should do, you better do it.
Any other questions from the panel members? Then we'll hear rebuttal argument from Ms. Hunt. You may proceed.
The transit team safety manual provisions that appear to be at issue are quoted on page 14 of my appellant's brief, and it's from section 5 under lift safety. The first one is that drivers should ride the lift with all manual chairs, with most electric chairs, and when possible with scooters. We recognize that some mobility devices are too large for the driver to drive safely ride with the passenger. And that was the situation here. The scooter is large, Ms. Bryden was large. There was no ability for the driver to ride with her on the lift if we ever got that far. And actually the video will show you that, because what happened is after she was put upright, she got on the lift, and then it shows her being lowered on the lift, and then the driver walks with her to her apartment. So that provision really has no implication here really at all. It's the second one that's quoted. When passengers and mobility devices are departing, we should, whenever possible, ride down the lift with the passenger. Okay, we're talking about the one ahead, where that wasn't possible here. And that may mean that we deploy the lift and make certain that it is even with the floor of the vehicle prior to releasing tie downs. So it's may. There is no provision in here requiring that the driver not use his discretion to back her up so she's situated, untied, and then go outside.
Just so I'm clear, Russell? You're saying the discretionary part of that phrase is when possible, not the word should.
Well, the thing is, ride down the lift with the passenger doesn't even occur here. I mean, that's not what they're complaining about. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's not even relevant.
But I understand that. But as to the operative language, assuming it was relevant, you're pointing to the language that whenever possible to apply to make this discretionary, as opposed to the word should.
Right. We should, whenever possible, ride down the lift with the passenger. And like I said, that is.
So you're not. So just so I'm clear, you're not emphasizing. I was asking with Mr. Nolan that I was suggesting maybe the word should is possibly a discretionary term, not a mandatory term. You're conceding that it is?
No, I'm saying it's discretionary. And when you couple that with the provision that I quote above that, which talks about the fact that we recognize that with some mobility devices, they're too large for the drivers to safely ride. So, I mean, you're putting the two together in essence, but, you know, all of that really, it gets us nowhere in this case because it has really nothing to do with the lift.
Counsel, on that point, it seems to me that the crux of this case is the storage of these straps and whether or not that interfered in the vehicle before we got to descending on the lift. Do you agree that at least with regard to the requirement to stowing straps, that's ministerial?
And I agree with that.
But you think the evidence is insufficient on that?
Is that the evidence is that they were stored, but I disagree with the initial premise that you made that that's the crux of the case, because the crux of the case is articulated by the plaintiff was the fact that she was left untied and then he was leaving. So that seems to be the crux.
No, I mean, but then she was left untied. He's not there. The straps weren't stowed. The straps caused the accident.
Correct.
I don't see how you get that. There is no claim that her, well, it's, the storage of the straps is necessary to the claim.
I don't think it is. I think that you could have the, under their theory of negligence.
Okay. That's what you're saying. She was left alone. Even if the straps were stored, she was left alone. Therefore, they're responsible.
Exactly. And
but if I guess what I'm saying, the crux of this, it's like the one thing I'm hearing, I think I hear you concede that any negligence based on storage of the straps, you're not contesting that storage of the straps is a ministerial function, but you are contesting whether or not the evidence is sufficient to survive summary judgment.
Correct. And if you go back and look at their response to our motion to dismiss, they were not focused at all on stowage of the straps. I mean, their whole the whole premise really was the idea that you should not have untied her, as I understand it. So we ask on this record that this court reverse and order this case dismissed.
Thank you for the arguments. The case is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days. And that concludes this hearing on the court's calendar this morning.